My name's Annie Ryan, from Chicago originally. I trained as an actor with Byrne and Joyce Piven in a tiny studio where they taught theater games and improvisation, and that basically formed the foundation of the work I still do now. When I was a teenager, I went professional and did a couple of films. I was in Ferris Bueller for about 5 minutes and various other things. I made my stage debut at the Goodman Theater in The Tempest in Bob Falls production. And then I went to New York University where I was hoping to study proper acting. It wasn't really that great, it turned out. But anyway, in my third year, I went to Trinity College in 89-90 and met a whole bunch of people that I still work with today. And then I went back to Chicago and joined New Crime Productions, which was founded by John Cusack, very name droppy here, and Jeremy Piven, who's the son of the Pivens who taught me, and was part of this Commedia company. So that Commedia work also is very much part of what the Corn Exchange is.
My name is Michael West. I'm a writer. I'm from Dublin. I went to school in Dublin. I went to King's Hospital out in the West, where my father was a teacher. I saw my first productions, I suppose, out there of things like Gilbert and Sullivan with the German teacher with a pillow shoved up a shirt and massive face paint. First time I saw theatre, I thought you had to have 6 layers of pancake and a fake nose. And I'm not sure that's entirely wrong.
I'm Dervla Crotty. I'm an actor and I'm from Cavan Town. I stumbled across acting and drama really quite late, at about 15 or 16, when there was an announcement over the intercom at my school, Loretta College, Cavan, that certain people were being called to audition for a production of Sound of Music, which was the first production that had been attempted at Loretta College, Cavan. So I went to Sister Josephine and demanded an audition. And I succeeded in securing the part of Max Detweiler, who is a Nazi entrepreneur. I then went to St. Patrick's College, Cavan, which is an all-boys school, and had the delight of playing Mrs. Squeers in a musical there, in Squeers, actually, which was Oliver by any other name, I think. My claim to fame is that during my sexy song, in which I did strange things with a feather boa, the then president of the college, Father Dan Gologli, would get up and leave every night on cue. So I was delighted with that.
My name is Mark O'Halloran. I'm an actor slash writer. I'm from Ennis in County Clare. I'm the 8th child of 10. So childhood for me was performative in nature. So we all had a way of performing to get attention, I think. And also my father was a great singer and raconteur. So in a way, I think performance was in the blood.
So I moved back to Dublin in 1992 and I had all of this stuff to teach. I really thought I was going to be an actor here. I don't know why I was so deluded. Like, there aren't really very many roles for me. But anyway, I had been teaching already for quite a long time, even though I was really young. And I had all of these games, and I had this Commedia style. I had all of this work to teach. And in 1993, Michael Murphy and Veronica Coburn and Raymond Keene began exploring what might be Barabbas. And they held a 3-week workshop in March where the likes of Dinny Conway and Andrew Bennett and Cindy Cummings and Michelle Reed and a whole bunch of people came, and they asked me to teach for a week. And there was just such hunger for it. And, you know, the New York school, in my experience, was full of people whose training was so rigid that they were like, oh, no, I don't work like that. But in Dublin, people would do absolutely anything, and they were so hungry for it.
A week before I went to UCD, I went into Trinity and joined Trinity Players without telling them that I was at UCD, because I was so crazy to do something and I really didn't know that UCD DramSoc existed. I went on to UCD. I found out that DramSoc did indeed exist, and then I really spent the next 3 years in DramSoc and not studying for my law degree. But I did finally graduate from there, and a highlight of any year really was ISDA, the Student Drama Festival, which is where I first spied Annie Ryan and Michael West.
So I started writing in college. I originally started writing clotted poetry. That was, I suppose, how you approach the whole idea of committing words, the sin of words on pages. And I was reading all sorts of things. And although I was studying drama, it hadn't occurred to me to write plays as such. And what happened was, there was John McGarren was the writer in residence 1 year, and I had submitted my clotted poems. and he met us all to return our work. And the normal way these things worked was that a very distinguished person of letters, usually male, would read people's portfolios and then reject most of them and take two or three off for very careful conversations. And so with that expectation, most people wouldn't turn up for the humiliation of getting your stuff back. But McGahan announced that he was simply going to meet everyone at this particular time in the arts box. So along we went on a grey evening in the smog, and John McGahan was there in his jacket, bang on time, very much like the teacher that he used to be. And he handed out one by one people's portfolios, and he said, well done to everyone. And he said something privately to them as they went up to the desk. And I was thinking, well, this isn't very dramatic. He just announced the whole thing that, look, I don't really have any ability or right to judge people's work. So if anyone wants to come and be in this thing, you're very welcome. So we completely deflated it as an elite exercise, handed people's stuff back. And I was waiting for my one, and it didn't come, and I was waiting. And some people would hang around and then leave, but there really was nothing happening other than he was handing back the things. And I was the very last envelope, and I went up to get them, and he said, I liked your poems, but then I know nothing about poetry. Was what he said. The next time he said we'll meet in his rooms, and they were in Rubrics, which is the old red brick building in Trinity. The numbers had whittled down quite considerably at that stage. Most people probably too scared to go. And there was about 12 of us sitting in this strange old building, and he just told stories very slowly, very carefully, again, without any kind of flash comic element to them or anything. But sometimes they were outrageously funny. Sometimes they were absolutely shocking. But they were all about the craft of writing, the idea of being a writer. And it was just a wonderful privilege to meet him on a regular basis. He was writing amongst women at the time.
I went to the Gaiety School of Acting, and my career started pretty slow after that. I got, you know, one line here. My first real professional job was in a touring production of Juno and the Paycock, in which I had two lines, one of which was, "Do yez want any coal blocks?" But I got to understudy the part of Johnny Boyle, and Johnny Boyle was being played by Tom Murphy, the late, great Tom Murphy, who went on to play alongside me in Adam and Paul. So it all began to click into place after that. And then I ran into the Corn Exchange crowd, which was the real circus, I suppose.
And then we began to perform the Commedia work in nightclubs, in a nightclub called Elevator in the old Ormond Multimedia Centre run by Tony Walsh, and he asked us to come in and perform. So we would have maybe 10 actors in whiteface, me on drums usually, and we would perform to all these little ravers on ecstasy. It was completely wild. And then by the time Jimmy Fay began the Fringe Festival in 1995, we had work that was ready to platform. We had something to show, and it was already sort of really underground, kind of bubbling away. And I had kept teaching, myself and Michael were teaching a course out in Ballyfermot at the animation school at the time. And we needed a name for ourselves. And I came across the sign of the Corn Exchange building on the quays. And I thought, this is perfect, because what I want to do is exchange technique, performance technique, physical theater, dance forms, but at its core, there is this sense of humor. So back in Chicago, in the Commedia company, the guys used to always say, "You work like a dog, but anything for a cheap gag." And they would always call for, like, more corn, please, you know, meaning just be ridiculous, or, you know, don't ever take it too seriously.
So I had met the Corn Exchangers towards the mid to late 90s. I was too afraid to play in the nightclub and all of that. And the nightclubs weren't really my scene at that point. But I did go to the workshops, and the work kind of resonated with me because I'm a terrible messer. And yet, you know, you can be a messer and still have a bit of a dark heart going on. And that's what the heart of Corn Exchange work is about, for me anyway, I thought. And you could go to these workshops, and the way the workshops were lined up was that there'd be trestle tables full of makeup, racks of clothes, and you had to just go through these racks of clothes and find a costume and an image and put on makeup and play, just play like a child would play, with Annie playing drums and shouting at you going, "That's not good, get off." But it was a wonderful training ground for physically embodying work and for character building, etc. And then at one point, Annie offered me a part in one of her plays, and I was absolutely delighted. It was in The Seagull, the Chekhov, which Michael had adapted, and I was playing the part of Medvedenko, which is a really small part, but it was one of my favourite parts I have ever played, because I got to be silent a lot on stage and yet be upstage of everybody doing things, which, if anybody knows me, is a disastrous thing to ask Mark O'Halloran to be upstage of them doing things in a play he doesn't have a lot to say in. So I had the time of my life in that play. I was like, I suddenly felt I could act, which was kind of strange because it was about 10 years into my career. But I suddenly felt, I can do this. I can actually do this. And that was the start of a really close relationship between myself and Annie and Michael as well, you know, with the work. And after that, I think one of the big things we did after that was Dublin by Lamplight, which was, it was hard work, but the rehearsals for that were fun and filled with chaos and creativity. And it was the hardest work nearly that I had ever done in a rehearsal room. And we were coming up to it going, does any of this work? Does any of it work? And I remember we did the first preview. I thought it was a car crash, a complete and utter car crash, because we couldn't see the work anymore. We were 6 weeks into this new play, this new form of presenting plays. And I remember going out that night to bow, and the audience were going crazy, but I thought they were going crazy because they knew us and they were being very supportive because we had just made idiots of ourselves. But they were actually really enjoyed it. But I remember taking a very tentative bow that night and then afterwards realizing, oh, actually, this is incredibly good. And then learning to love playing it. And that Dublin by Lamplight was another of those freeing moments where you realized there was a whole world out there to play with. And I'm forever thankful that I was in it, I have to say.
After UCD, in fact, I think on the day that I graduated, yes, I had an audition, late audition for Trinity for the very new acting course, 2 year diploma. And I went along and was called back. I did more improvisations and so on in the afternoon and was told that day that I was in. So really, I had no time to fret and wonder whether it was the right thing. And I leapt in there and spent two very fruitful years with Nigel Warrington off campus in horrible two rooms, very much not your idea of going to Trinity, which was always, you know, kind of fantastic goal, a real immersion. And if it didn't give me anything else, but it did give me lots, it gave me this that idea of work and the dedication, and also a sense that I had in some way earned the right to go out there and present myself.
In many ways, I would date my sort of arrival or beginning as a writer to a play called Foley, which is a one-man show I wrote for Andrew Bennett. And it was a show that Annie directed for the Corn Exchange. And we wrote it on the cusp of the millennium, depending on how you count these things, but sort of the winter of 99. And the biggest lesson I learned in writing Foley was that a one-man show is still a play about a full cast of people. You know, you can have one actor, but you're still telling a full story. Like, who is he? Who are his parents? Who are his loved ones? Who are the people he meets? Who are his significant others? What are the obstacles? And that was, it seems like such an obvious observation, but it was, again, going back to this idea of there's nothing there, and this lovely idea that he can tell any story he wants, but there's no way of cheating the basic story, which is, what is the fullness of that life? What is the heart of it? And what is the most burning thing that he has to get off his chest, which is why he's talking there. So the idea of the play is a sort of a love poem to... it came from the idea of my father, who's very good at going to funerals. And we would joke about it that, you know, if you were diligent enough, you could see off all the Protestants in Ireland. You could travel around from parish to parish, watching the dwindling tribe dwindle further. And from that idea, the idea came from Foley, the character, was obsessed with the idea that he was closing off the line, that this was the end of it, and that there'd be no more after him. He was the full stop at the end of all this generation, all this evolution and fruitcake, as he puts it.
So the 90s was a very restful period for me. I toured this amazing production, my very first professional job, June on the Paycock, where I had two lines in it and understudy Tom Murphy. But it was a brilliant production. It went into the West End and everything. So I got paid loads of money to do Arsol, except look at incredible Irish actors. Anita Reeves was playing Juno, Niall Buggy was in it, Mark Lambert was in it. Really extraordinary people. And it's a play that I absolutely love, and I know it inside out. And I just used to watch it every night. By the time we came back from that tour, it was 8 months on the road, partying across England. And I came back, certainly I was ruined for the rest of humanity. I was useless. I was a complete actor by that point. I was so immersed in the circus that there was no going back. I couldn't work in a regular job after that. And so I kind of ambled along through the Dublin of the 90s, not getting huge parts although this one play came along, which I played a hurler from Clare, much to the shock of the people of County Clare, the idea of me playing a hurler. But it was in a play called Rosie and Star Wars by Charlie O'Neill. And we toured around the country, and it was the last play that my father saw before he died. He died 2 days after we brought the play back to Ennis in County Clare, and was bringing it back, and my dad was really proud. And after the play, he could be quite silent when he wanted to be. And afterwards, we went to his local pub, and he was sitting there, And he was sitting at the end of the bar and he hadn't said anything. And it was a big part that I had. And all my relatives were at it that night. And they all went, "Roar!" at the end. And I went up to him halfway through the night and I said, "Dad, did you enjoy it?" And he said, "I thought your facial expressions were wonderful." Which I thought was like the blessing of blessings. After that, I knew I was on my way.
So I finally got to work with Corn Exchange on a play called Everyday. One day in the lives of, I think we had about 12, maybe 15 characters between six of us. At some point, their paths might cross. Really, we had the beginning of the day, the middle of the day, and then the end, and maybe the beginning of the next day, during which people threw themselves in canals, saved themselves, had their hearts broken, lost long-standing relationships, were evicted, killed the thing they loved. All in a day, and the sun rose again and some of them were left standing.
We started exploring different characters for the play every day, which were all different walks of life in Dublin. But really it became about loneliness and about a feeling of disconnectedness, but also great humour. And we had the great pleasure to play with Dervla, who created this amazing character with Michael called Madeline Byrne O'Brien, who was having an affair with this property mogul. And Mark O'Halloran played Aidan Wallace, who was a failed musician who wanted to be a teacher. Anyway, it was a really wonderful play set in one day about contemporary Dublin.
So in 2004, we did a play called Dublin by Lamplight. The title comes from a Joyce short story. The story is Clay from the book Dubliners, which was a book that Annie and I had started reading and we were talking about bringing to the stage at some point. But anyway, the title came early and it came from a very simple idea, which was 2004 was the 100th year anniversary of the founding of the National Theatre, but also a fictional centenary of the book Ulysses. And so we thought we could do the two things together, tell the story of the founding of the Irish National Theatre, but set it on a single day like Ulysses. And that was the sort of the collision. And the play itself was inspired by, I was reading Roy Foster's amazing biography of Yeats at the time. And what struck me again and again was the strange smallness of Dublin, that Yeats already thought very highly of himself. And he really didn't need to be worrying about the colour of the dress in the background. And the guy happened to borrow a coat for the performance or something, or could he get the loan of a chair? But he totally immersed himself in that world. And I recognised that world as that is the make and do startup. And I was very taken by his passion. And the other sort of framing device that we had going into Dublin by Lamplight was very much a sense of brothers, the Yeats brothers, the Fay brothers in the Abbey Theatre, and also the Pierce brothers, and mixing the idea of these brothers working together. And then in the devising process, Annie spoke about Louis Lovett and Mark O'Halloran, and they effectively were sort of improvising brothers, but their characters weren't brothers as such. And there was this energy of interrupting and going off to different parts of the city, and that was very interesting because the story was driven by that almost struggle of equals, but they weren't brothers, unlike as Mark was working on with Adam and Paul. It wasn't a double act of people together. It was two characters dragging us around the city, and it gave a really amazing dynamic to the movement of scenes. And we really wanted to go for a filmic kind of no set transformational world where you could jump from a tenement into a castle or out into the streets and follow it through. So that was the basic structure.
We had done Lolita and various other productions in the kind of Commedia style, and it was time to make something that was entirely our own. So eventually Dublin by Lamplight became a story set in 1904 about this fictional version of creating the Irish National Theatre of Ireland. And Willie Hayes was its director. And this was the night that they were going to perform The Wooing of Emer. So they did The Wooing of Emer in the Temperance Hall. And this was also the day that the king arrived in Dublin. So one of the actors who was playing Cú Chulainn decided to make a political statement. So he leaves the play to set a bomb underneath the king. It all turns completely upside down and they lose the play and they lose their theatre, and Willie Hayes ends up lost in Monto and comes to a tragic end. Da, 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 da.
Dubliners is one of those sort of secret books that underlies a lot of people's lives. I think that the stories are so accessible and so easy to read and so moving and fresh and powerful, and the older you get, the more shocking it is that Joyce seems to get younger and younger as you read them. So as I say, it was a book that was in the background. We'd been inspired by it going way back to Dublin by Lamplight, but also with Everyday, the idea of telling fragmented narratives, small stories, close up in the city. And then the opportunity presented itself in 2012, talking to the Dublin Theatre Festival, the opportunity came to present some version of Dubliners on the Gaiety stage, and we said absolutely not. I mean, it was our idea, but as soon as they asked us, well, let's go ahead and do it, we tried desperately to get out of it and say, we just need more time, it's actually very big, it's too big, but we had to go for it. And it was a thrilling encounter with the stories, and we assembled a crack team, including Dervla and Mark, and we just attacked it head on. So the way we approached it was that we would have to respect the structure of the book, starting at the beginning and going to the end, which sounds quite obvious, but the book itself comprises 15 stories, getting longer and longer and culminating in the great set piece of The Dead, which is one of the great jewels of Irish literature. That alone is about 13,000 words and would take up an hour or two if you just read it. So we're going, well, we can't do all of that. We're going to have to do some way of navigating through all these different stories. So we will select the spine of the stories through the book. Joyce himself famously wrote in a letter that he saw the journey in the book from adolescence into maturity and public life, and that you follow that curve. So we knew we had to take a little bit of childhood, a little bit of mature life and the public life. So that was the basic kind of arc of it, and that it would have to end with the dead. It would have to end in the hotel room and the snow all over Ireland. So we knew that, and we began working then, Annie and I, on the adaptation to try and strip these things down and make the choices of which stories we would go. So we did about half of them. One of the highlights being Boarding House and Counterparts, which is the story of alcoholism and beating a child, and A Painful Case, which is one of the most beautiful stories in the collection, played by both Dervla and Mark, which is a story of thwarted love and lost opportunities.
In the 90s, I wasn't terribly busy, so I spent a lot of time looking out my window, and I lived up around Mountjoy Square, Parnell Street, and I used to see a lot of homeless heroin addicts around the place. And also, when I first moved to Dublin, I'd never seen heroin addicts because they didn't have them in Ennis at the time. And so one of the first days I was in Dublin, I was walking down the O'Connell Street, and there was a young fella with a hypodermic syringe in one hand and in the other hand a cigarette smoked all the way down to the filter that had burnt out. And he fell over in slow motion, and it took him about 7 minutes to fall over, which I thought was quite extraordinary because I was studying mime at the time inside in the Gaiety School of Acting, and we had done falling over in slow motion and it was very painful. And I thought, well, all I had to do was become a heroin addict and I could do it. But it was a kind of a weird world. It was like there was a strange dance going on around at the city centre, which my eyes were very open to because I wasn't living in Dublin very long. And I began to take sort of diary entries about things that I'd seen heroin addicts do in town, and it gradually morphed into this thing where I began to write plays, little plays that were put on in Bewley's, and this producer called Johnny Spears came to see it. He was a friend of a friend, and he set me up with Lenny Abrahamson, and they wanted to know, did I have any ideas for a screenplay? And I had this idea for this very rough idea called Adam and Paul, about two heroin addicts who wandered around the city over one day looking for heroin, and it started at sunrise and it ended at sunrise on the one day. And, you know, in the middle of it, I knew in the middle of it they'd meet a baby. And that was pretty much all I knew. And I knew the power dynamic between the two of them. So that kind of, and it also, I mean, I think it did feed into the work that we've been doing with Corn Exchange. And also it fed into, you know, if you're living in Dublin and you're an actor living in Dublin, you're reading Joyce and you're reading Beckett. So all of those ideas were in it as well. I mean, Joyce, I think, especially that one day in Dublin, it's over everything. You can't do anything in Dublin except reference it. And it's almost the same with Waiting for God. That play, you can't do a play nowadays without some reference to it. It's always there. It's the bedrock of Irish theatre in lots of ways.
So we had done Dublin by Lamplight and then Every Day, and we thought, okay, it's time to make another original piece, a Dublin contemporary piece. And then this was in November 2008, and then the economy collapsed. So we thought, okay, great. Well, let's make a piece about change, about the feeling of the rug being pulled from underneath you. And that eventually became Freefall. In the arts, we've all found the boom like unbelievably depressing, because there's no way any of us will ever own a house, or I still feel like that's probably true. But it really became about grief. It became about the idea that if there is great change in your life, no matter what it is, you have to grieve for that. Even if it's a good change, you have to grieve for the passing of something. But that one was not done in the Commedia style because it didn't seem like the right kind of energy for it. But again, the same ensemble transformation work. So that was our sort of Dublin trilogy of Dublin by Lamplight, Every Day, and Freefall. And then our fourth in the trilogy became Man of Valor, which was a one-man show with Paul Reed, again, set in Dublin, about really pulling yourself up out of the muck and forging on, hero story. And we're just about to embark on a brand new play with Michael, which we're making up again. So once again, I'm not sure, we're not quite sure, but I have a feeling it should be about being had.
I remember once going to the pub with all of the cast right in the middle of every day, and we were dizzy at this stage. And Mark proposed that night that what we should do the next day is that we should come in with an idea of the one thing that we've always wanted to do on stage but were afraid to ask. And Mark's contribution was that he always wanted to sing Life on Mars unaccompanied on the stage. And he brought that in to Annie the next day, and Annie responded immediately and asked him how he might do that and where he thought that might happen. And that idea and the embrace of that idea created really the central scene in Every Day. My idea was to wax myself on stage to great pain and clamour, and to talk myself through that. And that also was embraced.
While we use this commedia style, and really that's just a word for how to get people to be totally embodied moment to moment. And it's quite a stylized form, and it has lots of rules, and it looks a particular way. It comes with makeup masks and so forth. But really, it's really about just very embodied acting. And we also enjoy taking the mask away and coming out of that style, but still informed by that same embodiment. So, in fact, our last production, which was Desire Under the Elms by O'Neill, was not in the style, but certainly the rules and the vocabulary of the company's work is at play all the time in rehearsals.
It's an extraordinary thing. I mean, you don't know if a play works until you put it in front of an audience, and an audience will tell you what the play is really about and if it works and how you can improve it. But before all that, you're reliant on your own instinct, stumbling around in the blind darkness, but also the sensitivity and intelligence and creativity of other people. And what's wonderful about the atmosphere that Annie creates in the room is that it's not a free-for-all exactly, but there's a sort of a good-natured, very fair sense of, well, look, if anyone has a good idea, for God's sake, don't hide it. You know, whoever says, and one of the great hallmarks of the work that Annie does is sometimes a beautiful lighting idea will come from a set designer or from an actor or vice versa. People, it's a carefully managed thing, as I say, it's not a free-for-all, not everyone's commenting or criticising, but there's a sense in which good ideas just need to be surfaced, brought out and tested, because they might not work, and that's no harm either. And that's been a really great education as a writer, but as a theatre maker, which is what we really are in a room, is that, look, we're all trying to tell stories. The great thing about actors is that they are natural storytellers. With the time that they have on stage, they're telling stories. And it's absolutely no surprise to me that Mark would be such a wonderful writer. And he would say himself that acting is a great storytelling university to do it night after night in front of people. So I've learned so much watching actors at work, and how you make a scene better through just the drop of a shoulder, let alone, you know, cutting the whole thing or changing lines. That it's a whole three-dimensional process, and it's been a great privilege.
The only thing that happens really when Annie cracks the whip is she'll say in rehearsal rooms, "I think we're having too much crack."
That's only with you.
All right, lads, we're having too much crack.